Well, good morning. Hope everybody's doing okay this morning. I am thankful to be with you. Appreciate the invitation to be here. I very much appreciate Mark, and I have known Mark and his family for many, many years. He's a fellow Florida native of some years of exile like me now. And but I've known Mark and his family for a long time. I'm thankful to be over here with you. This is my first time being in this congregation, so I'm glad to come over here and see y'all and meet you a little bit. I've obviously known of y'all for a long time, and have one of your good friends over my way. Tony Mock, of course, is not far from me, and I know Tony spent many good years here, and so I love and appreciate Tony, as I know you do too. Love and appreciate Mark and Zeke. I've met more recently, past couple of years, but I've grown to appreciate very much Zeke and who he is and the kind of man of God that he is. But I'm glad to be with you this morning, and I appreciate very much the things you've been talking about this week, these foundational stories from Genesis. I think one of the things that we forget sometimes as Christians is that ultimately being a Christian is not just being a moral person. That part of what it means to be a Christian is to confess a certain understanding of history. That God has not just called us to live a certain way, He's called us to believe and trust in what He's doing in the world. And that story of what He's done in the world, we usually think of through Jesus, and that's true. To be a Christian means that you confess that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, that He was crucified and on the third day raised from the dead. And that's just as much a part of being a Christian as living an ethical life. In other words, to believe in the history, the work of God among mankind. But also, really, that story of Jesus begins back here in these basic pages of Genesis. That Jesus' story starts here, Genesis chapter 3, when God first makes that statement to Eve that the seed of woman will crush the serpent's head, that there will be a final victory. And that story, after wondering how that's going to work out, I understand this week have talked about like Noah and the flood, how it's basically gotten a lot worse since the garden. And then basically God once again decides to begin to save the human race. In earnest, but rather than building an ark this time, he builds a family. It's Abraham's family. I don't know if you've ever thought about it this way, but really, you have two cycles in these early chapters of Genesis that get us up to Abraham and what God's going to do through Abraham. The first cycle, of course, is creation itself, and that leads us to Eden. It leads us to the fall. The human race continues to decline after the fall. You've got Cain and you've got Abel. And then you have sin spreading through mankind, especially Cain's line, but even Seth's line's eventually corrupted. And sin spreads to the point that God decides He's going to destroy the world. The human race corporately in rebellion against them, the thoughts of hearts continually evil. And so God tells Noah to build a boat. You're going to need it. And he builds that boat, and he and just a handful of people, his family, think about that, his family, are what are saved from that destruction. And well, they come off the ark, and it doesn't take long for sin to reassert itself in the world. You have Noah getting drunk, and just like Adam had three named sons, Noah has three named sons. One of them is lost, so to speak, Ham, and his misbehavior towards his father. And that leads to a new curse against Ham, just like there was a curse in the original fall. And sin spreads once again, and it culminates with the entire human race being in rebellion again. It's the Tower of Babel story, all mankind gathered together. To build a great city, tower up in the heavens. And we always focus on the tower in that story, but really, the real issue is let's make a name for ourselves. Let's redefine who we are. Because remember, man was named by God to begin with. Man got to name all the other animals, but who named man? God did. And now man says at Babel, let's make a name for ourselves. Let's redecide for ourselves what history is, what the nature of our existence is. But interestingly, this time, faced again with corporate human rebellion, God does not destroy the world, not yet. He calls a man again. This man's name was Abraham. And once again, it's going to be only this man and his family, a much larger family than Noah's, as it's going to turn out, because you and I are part of that family. But one man and his family are going to be what's saved from the coming destruction. We're still waiting for that coming destruction. It's called the second coming of Jesus. But what God has been doing for the past 4,000 years is building a different kind of boat. It's the family of Abraham, first through the flesh, and then later through the Spirit. And so that's really what Israel is about. And that's what we are about. And that is what God has called us to. And so Genesis chapter 12, you know the story here. Very, very well. But really, it's for our purposes even. It's really Paul's interpretation of this story that we can start with this morning. Is there a way to turn this on? Or there it is. Okay. Oh, there we go. Yeah. All right. Galatians chapter 3, Paul's commentary here a little bit on this text. When you look at what Paul says back in Galatians chapter 3. And so Scripture, foreseeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith, by the way, that's us. That's people like us, how we get into this story. The Scripture, foreseeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith, preached the gospel beforehand to Abraham, saying, "In you shall all the nations be blessed." That's Genesis 12. You've already studied that, I believe, this week, and you've been there and you've seen that. So then, those who are of faith are blessed along with Abraham, the man of faith. And then Paul goes on, dropping down about verse 26 or so. "For in Christ Jesus, you are all sons of God through faith. For as many of you as were baptized into Christ have put on Christ. And if you are Christ, then you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to the promise." You hear that? Abraham's offspring. You're Abraham's offspring as well if you are in Christ. That's really where this story that we're looking at in Genesis 12 with Abraham and his descendants, Isaac, who we're going to talk about a little bit this morning, that's really where this story is headed. That we are just as much children of promise to Abraham in a sense. Abraham really is, when you stop and think about it in the Bible, Abraham's life and story really are the quintessential human story. In the aftermath of Eden, sin spreading through the world, what does God want of fractured human beings? What does God want? What does the righteous human life look like this side of Eden? This side of the flood? This side of Babel? What does the righteous life look like? And God, rather than just giving us a list in one sense in Genesis, rather than just giving us a list of here are the things you need to do morally speaking, here's a checklist, here's some bullet points, here's what you do. God doesn't so much tell us, He shows us. He shows us in the story of the life of Abraham. Now, Abraham's life, of course, begins to get interesting in Genesis chapter 12. You know this, when the Lord said to Abraham, "Go forth from your country and from your fathers, your relatives, to the land which I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and the ones who curse you, I will curse." And so here you have Abraham called, again, to build a boat, so to speak, to separate himself from the world of his time, to leave the city, the culture that he's been born in, to leave his family. He's called to leave his family. And to go to a foreign part of the world, the place where God will show him, and there to live and wait for the blessing of God. That's Abraham's life. That's what Abraham is called to do. And so it's interesting that in one sense, when you look at Abraham's story, on the one sense we look at Abraham, he seems to be a man who seems to have everything on one level, but is missing what culturally may have been the most important thing, children. I mean, we know that part of his story. He and his wife Sarah, by the time we meet them in this story, they're 75 years old. They are well past, even though people lived longer back then, they are well past the time when you're going to have children, physically speaking. And they knew that. They weren't foolish. They were not naive. They knew that the biological clock had run out. And so no matter how much wealth you have, how much comfort, security you have, then like now, it's really the intangible things in life that matter. And they had no children. And so the irony of his name, I'm sure, and I know that you are good Bible students here and well taught, his name is painful. His name means something like father or exalted father. His name that his father gave him is itself a kind of a constant reminder of the biggest thing that lacks in his life. And so one day God shows up and he tells Abraham to go. Doesn't tell him where he's going, but he tells him to go. And ultimately, this is something that the Jews, even down to Jesus' day, missed, is that Abraham's journey was not for his or for the Jews' sake alone. It was to become a blessing and living this new kind of life, this different kind of life. God's answer to Babel, God's answer to sin, God's answer to human rebellion. He was to live this life not for his own or for his physical descendants' benefit, but for all who would come to know God, Paul says. Scripture foresaw this. All who would come to know God through Jesus. It was not for himself or even his own biological family alone that he would do this. And so the story is a bumpy one. You know, we know Abraham's story. We know the bits and pieces of it as we move towards the birth of Isaac. We know the story, but I don't think we often always connect the dots smoothly all the way through
in terms of what is going on in this story here in Genesis. And so in Genesis chapter 12, he takes the journey. And you remember some of his early adventures. He kind of pawns Sarah off on Pharaoh because he's afraid to acknowledge her as his wife. You know those stories. But what really gets interesting, stop for a sec. When you stop and think about it, that has implications for children, though. It actually has, you know, because the whole issue is, will she be sexually taken by Pharaoh? Not that she could bear children, but the bottom line is her sexual faithfulness to her husband is put at risk by his putting her in Pharaoh's house for his own skin's sake, basically. The story goes on. It begins to get really interesting in Genesis 15. Have your Bible, Genesis 15. It begins to pick up a little bit. Genesis chapter 15. Really begin to understand how much the issue of the children. We focus on other promises because they pertain to us. Maybe we see more. But this issue of no children is what really drives Abraham's relationship with God. He's not nearly as focused on the land as he is on the womb. So Genesis chapter 15. We know the story, but look at how it starts. Genesis 15 and verse 2. Abraham said, O Lord God, what will you give me because I continue childless? And the heir of my house is Eleazar of Damascus. Now, by this point in the story, he's already separated from Lot. Some commentators have suggested, I think there may be something to this, that Lot, originally, Abraham may have seen Lot as his potential heir. It makes sense because Lot's father was Abraham's brother, but that brother had passed away. So Lot needs a dad. Abraham needs a son. We'll solve everybody's problems. And so some commentators have suggested that even though God told Abram to leave his family behind when he goes, he takes Lot with him because perhaps Lot was really seen more as a kind of a quasi-adopted son. But as you well know, by Genesis chapter 14 and 13 and 14, Lot has separated from Abram. Their wealth had become too great. He now lives in Sodom. And so in a sense, he and Abram really aren't acting like family anymore. They have separated and gone their separate ways. And so now apparently Abram sees Eleazar, his most trusted servant, steward, what have you, as his heir. And it's become personal because now at least Lot, if that's what was going on, at least Lot was related by blood. At least he was kin of some sort. Eleazar, he's from Damascus. It's not even part of my family, really. But that's all I got, God. Been doing this a while. Some years have passed by the time Genesis 15 happens. God, and Abraham explicitly lays the issue at the feet of God. God, I'm still childless. Can we have a down payment? Can we have some sort of sign? Can you give me something to hold on to? Because I've been holding up my end of the deal for a while. And of course, you remember the rest of the story, that God will basically make a covenant with Abram, the torch passing between the animal parts, which is basically God's way and the way covenants were made and the symbolism of covenants. It was God's way of basically saying, Abraham, you can trust me because basically, may I have done to me what's been done to this animal if I don't fulfill my word to you. Basically, in a sense, putting himself under risk of death, which is entirely impossible for God, which is a pretty good way, therefore, to guarantee you're going to get what I promised. Because it's impossible for God to lie. It's impossible for God to die. It was God's way of guaranteeing to Abraham, trying to put his heart at ease. But what's really interesting then, what's really interesting is that when you turn the page to 16, the issue is still on the table. Chapter 16, verse 1. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. And so once again, the text comes back. This is really what's driving the plot in Abraham's life. Not so much the land, not so much in any of the other things. The child. No child. And so Sarah, Abraham's wife, had borne him no children. But she did have a female servant named Hagar. You know where this story is going. You've heard this before. And so Sarah will say to Abram, behold, now the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Go into my servant, and it may be that I shall obtain children by her. And so Sarah sees this as a surrogate arrangement. And Abram listened to the voice of Sarah. Now, I've heard that phrase before in Genesis. Have you? Genesis chapter 3, and the man listened to the voice of his wife. In fact, isn't that what God kind of chides Adam for? Because you listened to the voice of your wife? In other words, rather than basically standing firm? I've seen this before, haven't I? It's a subtle commentary on this. I'm already expecting a bad ending out of this story because I've seen this phrase before. In Genesis, when husbands listen to their wives instead of leading their wives, generally speaking in Genesis, bad things are about to happen. And Abram listens to Sarah, standing up saying, I made a covenant with God, torch passes through animals, God's going to get this done. I don't know how God's going to get this done. He listens to Sarah. And we're going to wind up with a whole Middle East problem that still exists to this day in one sense. Because Abram splits his line because he listened to the voice of his wife. And so sure enough, she goes in, she bears. But rather than making it better, verse 4, when Abram went into Hagar and she conceived, when she saw that she conceived, she looks at her mistress with contempt. And Sarah picks up on this verse 5, and Sarah says to Abraham, "May the wrong done to me be on you." I'm kind of sympathetic to Abram. He's in a no-win situation. You know if he'd actually, I mean, he should have done the right thing and told her no to begin with. But you know he's not going to get brownie points with her for saying no. She's going to be angry at him if he does. She's going to be angry with him if he doesn't. Still should have done the right thing. But Abraham is in a tough spot. And so, there is now animosity in Abram's house. There's angst between Abram and Sarai. There's problems between Sarai and Hagar. And at that point, even Hagar runs away on her own. What's really interesting, though, for sake of time, I want to jump on. Ishmael will be his name because God hears Hagar's cry. But chapter 17, it gets interesting because it's still all about the issue of these children. Chapter 17, verse 1, when Abram was 99 years old, the Lord again appears to him and says to him, "I am God Almighty, walk before me, be blameless, that I may make a covenant between me and you, and I may multiply you greatly." Abram fell on his face. God said to him, "Behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be the father of a multitude of nations." In fact, and here comes the name change. No longer will you be called Abram, now it's Abraham. And in the Hebrew, that Am added to the end is the Hebrew word for people. Now you are father of a people, father of a nation. Changes his name before he has the kid, or any other descendants for that matter, that God considers legitimate. God's doubling down on this promise, and again, in one sense, really, and we understand this, really asking Abram to exercise faith in what he can't see, rather than control in what he can. "Because I have made you the father of a multitude of nations, I will make you exceedingly fruitful. I will make you into nations, and kings shall come from you. I will establish my covenant between me and you, your offspring after you throughout their generations for an everlasting covenant, to be God to your offspring after you." In other words, I'm making a family, and it's not just going to be a biological family. I want you to realize right now when God changes Abraham's name, your family is going to be a family based upon faith. We're not having family reunions because we're all kin. We're having family reunions because we all worship the one true God. That's what he's saying to Abram in verses 6 and verse 7 and verse 8. That this is about basically a covenant that I will be God to you and to your offspring. And God keeps on talking to Abram and doubling down on it. And he gives him the covenant for the first time. He gives him the covenant of circumcision. Now think about that. And I don't know if you've ever thought about it to put the story together this way or not. Ishmael is the son of uncircumcised Abram. Isaac will be the son of circumcised Abraham. God gives him the sign of the covenant before he has the son. Again, to emphasize the nature of God's relation with Abram and that you have what I give you, not what you take on your own terms in your own time. You have in life what I give you. That's part of what faith is. That's part of what it means to live by faith. And so I will mark your flesh before you have the son to emphasize the nature of our covenant. I'll change your name to emphasize what's about to happen. But understand that it happens on my time and by my gift. You don't take, you don't manipulate it, you don't solve problems. Ishmael is the son of uncircumcised Abram. Isaac is the son of circumcised Abraham. And so your name is Abraham, you will be fruitful, you will have many descendants. Verse 16, God changes Sarah's name in verse 16. "I will bless your wife, and I will give you a son by her." That's the deal, Abram. Not just a son from you, but a son from you and her. "And I will do this. And I will bless her, and she shall become nations. Kings and people shall come from her." And then verse 17, as Mark alluded to just before we broke up for class, the beginning of the name of this son. Because at that point, Abram, we always think about Sarah in chapter 18. Actually, Abram's the first to laugh at this. Abram fell on his face and he laughed. In Hebrew, there's your word. That Hebrew root that becomes the name of Isaac. And he laughed and said to himself, "Shall a child be born to a man who is 100 years old?" Verse 21. Oh, actually, I'm sorry. Keep reading there a little bit. God responds to Abram, Abram says to God, verse 18, "Oh, that Ishmael might live before you." No, God, let's just take Ishmael. He's a good boy. He's a good boy. Let's just take Ishmael. Ishmael's enough. To which God says, "No, but Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son and shall call his name Isaac." Laughter. See, that's actually where the name starts. We always focus on the Genesis 18 story. His name is given here before he's even conceived. Because God hears Abraham's laughing even before he hears Sarah's. And so he marks him in the flesh. and tells basically him to go back to his wife, and that's where your son will come from. I'll take care of Ishmael, God says, but you, now marked with my covenant, with a better name to anticipate what I will do for you, must trust in me in my time to do this for you. And so, verse 21, God now puts himself on the clock. I will establish my covenant with you, whom Sarah shall bear to you, I will establish my covenant with Isaac, whom Sarah shall bear to you at this time next year. Now I'll put myself on the clock, God says, for the first time. You're marked. You got a name. I'll give you the name of your son. I heard what you did. And so now it's time. Well, chapter 18, then, you know, God will go down in his intention to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. That's when God also reiterates to Abram that by this time next year, you'll have a son. Sarah laughs at this point at that, just doubling down on the child's coming name, and so on and so forth. But for our sake of time, chapter 21, the child is born. Chapter 21, verse 1, the Lord visited Sarah as he said, and the Lord did to Sarah as he promised. And Sarah conceived and bore Abram a son in his old age at the time when God had spoken to him. And let me stop right there for a moment. God visited Sarah. You know, it's not like Abraham and Sarah haven't tried over the years to do this the biological way. I think we forget sometime, ladies and gentlemen, that at the end of the day, there's biology and there's still the miracle of life. And that God's always a partner in the creation of life. We forget that. Eve understood that the very first, you know, human child conceived and born of the natural way was Cain. But it's interesting, Genesis 4, Eve even confesses much, with the help of God I have begotten a man. There's always that miracle life. You and I may contribute to DNA, but the soul, that's God's business. And so God always, whether we realize it or not, even if we sit there and think, well, we're young, we're conceiving naturally, whatever, there's always that hand of God. And I think we forget that sometimes. It's as much God's doing as it is Abram and Sarah's. And that was the problem with Hagar. That's why Abram falls at that point. He listened to the voice of his wife. It's to be God's doing. It always is. And we're supposed to receive life as given by God rather than taken. And so Sarah conceived, bore son in Abram in his old age at the time when God had spoken to him. I love the way the text reads that. We just read that and move on, but think about what it says. It emphasizes the fact that, yes, this is God keeping his promise to Abram. He's old. The text doesn't have to throw that in. That's not gratuitous. It's there to remind us what has happened. And he's done it at the time he said. See, God never told Abraham a time back in Genesis 12. He just said it's going to happen. Here in chapter 17, chapter 18, he puts himself on the clock. Chapter 21 says an exactly right on schedule when God does give him the time, then it does happen. It's hard to wait sometimes in life, isn't it? It is hard to wait. We won't do this morning, but if you have some time this afternoon, over the weekend, take a concordance, or you younger folks on your phone, your search function, the word wait. And look how often it appears in the Psalms and especially the prophets. Blessed are those who wait on God. Because that's part of the life of faith, and that's part of where Israel ultimately comes from. God's creation, God's timing, God's way. And so it's interesting. Not only did Abram laugh back in chapter 17, did Sarah laugh in chapter 18, but once again in verse 6, Sarah said, God has made laughter for me, and everyone who hears will laugh over me. This boy is always causing laughter. And she said, who would have said to Abram that Sarah would nurse children, yet I have borne him a son in his old age. But there's one more episode of laughter as we move into Isaac's life. Verse 9, but Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian whom she had borne to Abram laughing. That boy would have been a teenager by now, at least 13, 14 years old. That boy, Ishmael, would have been a teenager by now. He's laughing. We assume probably derisively, but Sarah's old jealousy of Hagar comes back up at that point, which should have been a happy day. The old animosity is rekindled. Probably, why would Ishmael laugh? Well, he's probably not laughing at the baby. Stop and think about it. Up to this point, he's been Abram's most likely heir. But when you have a legitimate child of the lawful wife, Ishmael just took a demotion. And so it's naturally he would laugh, he would be derisive, he would mock. And this leads to Sarah once again going after Abram. She says to Abram, cast out this slave woman with her son, for the son of this slave woman shall not be heir with my son Isaac. And Abram, once again, will do what his wife says. This time with God's blessing, however, God does speak to the story. God said to Abram, do not be displeased because of the boy and the slave woman. Whatever Sarah says, do. I will be with them, basically, because Isaac is through whom your offspring will be named, will be called. And so there we have kind of Abram and Abram's introduction to Isaac. Isaac comes to the world basically of great concern to Abram, chapter 15, chapter 16, chapter 17, and then chapter 18, and then chapter 21. And the birth of Isaac comes with quite a bit of conflict. Hagar, Ishmael, even a little bit of angst between Abram and Sarah themselves. But the real elephant in the room when it comes to the story of Isaac and the beginning of Israel is Genesis chapter 22. That's always the elephant in the room. And that's probably the greatest testing. And that's how chapter 22 and verse 1 puts it. That's really the great, great testing that comes to Abram in relation to the Isaac story. The real testing was not in the waiting to receive. So that certainly tried Abram's faith. We see that in the Hagar episode. We see that in chapter 15. God, what will you give me to show that you really will keep your word? You only thought Abram was tested by waiting. The real test of faith sometimes is by letting go. And that's what chapter 22 is about. And so it came about after these things that God tested Abraham. You only thought he had been tested by waiting a quarter of a century, if the chronology is rightly understood. But now the real test comes. And by this point, we don't know for sure. There's no way to exactly date Genesis 22. Obviously, Isaac, by this point, the story is old enough to talk, old enough to carry wood. So we'll call him at least 15. That puts Abram 40 years post-Genesis 12 ballpark. We're not going to, dot I's and cross T's over that. But it gives us a rough idea. So 40 years, we're going to say, for our purposes, roundabout. Into this project, God's going to test Abraham. You only thought the testing was in the waiting. Sometimes the testing is in the letting go. After you've already received what you thought was the blessing from God. And so he said to him, Abram. And Abram responded, here I am. And he said, take now your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac. Why don't you stop there for a second? Again, the language is not gratuitous. The language is here for a reason. It's God almost twisting the knife to Abram to make sure everybody understands what's at stake. He could have just said, real simply, real bluntly, because God can't speak this way sometimes in the Bible. Get up, go, do, here, now. But that's not how God approaches Abraham. In fact, in Hebrew, the take now is almost, in Hebrew it's soft. There's a little particle in there in Hebrew that kind of softens it. I say soften it. It's still an imperative, but almost it's a way of kind of almost asking permission or, but without asking permission. In other words, God almost seems to understand the enormity of what he's about to ask Abraham to do. And that the rest of the language bears that out. Your son, your only son, the son whom you love, that son. I want you to go to the land of Moriah and go offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains I will tell you. Now, you don't have to have a lot of imagination to hear an echo of Genesis 12 in that as well. Go to the place I will show you. See, Genesis 12 is one side. Genesis 22 is the other side of how Abram's faith is teased out. The first was going and waiting. The second side is now giving up what you have received. Both sides demonstrate Abram's faith. We don't often connect that dot. But this is the counterpart. This is the antithesis to Genesis chapter 12. This is the other way that Abraham's faith is stretched, drawn out, demonstrated. And it's so much more powerful, ladies and gentlemen, rather than God telling us, here's what I want, than God showing us, this is what I want. This is the kind of human life I'm looking for. And so I want you to take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac. And I want you to go to the land of Moriah. And I want you to offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I will tell you. And so Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took his two young men with him, and Isaac his son. Again, the language is just piles up to emphasize that. Isaac his son. As though you forgot who Isaac is. And he split the wood for the burnt offering. And he rose and he went to the place of which God had told him. And again, the text, we could have said this a lot more succinctly. He went 3 days, he was there, he nearly sacrificed Isaac. The text wants to belabor every step to show the intentionality of Abraham's obedience. Every step of the preparation. The packing up. Calling a couple servants, go pack your bags, you're going on a trip, you'll need stuff for a few days. Splitting the wood. The detail is meant to add to the excruciating nature of what Abraham experiences, to put you in his shoes and to appreciate the resolve by which he is going to do what God has asked him. The Abraham who once asked God, how do I know that you're actually going to do this for me, is now being asked after God has done it for him to let it all go.
And so he arose and he went to the place of which God has told him. And on the third day, Abram raised up his eyes and he saw the place from a distance. And Abram said to his young men, stay here with the donkey and I and the lad will go over there and we will worship. That's an interesting word for Abraham to choose for what he's going to do, isn't it? You ever think about that? That's a fascinating word choice for what he's going to go and do. We're going to go and we're going to worship and we're going to return to you. Now, most of you, again, being good Bible students here, you're well aware of Hebrews 11's account of this part of the story, where Hebrews 11 talks about God, Abraham, by faith receiving Isaac back from the dead, convinced that God was able to raise him from the dead. Obviously, the Genesis story never shows that part of Abraham's mindset. Genesis never reveals that that's Abraham's thought process. But maybe here in this line, again, you've probably heard this before, pointed out, when Abraham talks about we will worship and we will return, that's what Abraham's implying. He believes that God's going to get him out of this somehow. Because he knows very clearly that God has already told him that his descendants will come through Isaac. God's made that explicit. God's made that clear. You see, folks, part of what happens in life, part of what happens in living the kind of life God wants human beings to live before him, is doing what seems to be contradictory and impossible sometimes. God has said Isaac will be the one through whom everything hangs, but go kill him. I don't reconcile that humanly speaking. How am I supposed to put this young man to death? And yet God still has made very clear, Ishmael's not the guy, your descendants, the ones that are going to count, are going to come through him. It's going to be through Isaac. Not just through any son that Sarah might have, but this son, Isaac. You know, God's doubled down. Not just a son with Sarah, but this particular son. Everything hangs on it. And so Abram is stuck with basically having to obey God, even though you cannot reconcile the two things God has said, which is, number one, everybody, your entire future comes through Isaac. And number two, kill him. Put him to death. Sometimes we are called to simply obey God and not worry about how God will work this out. That's not my problem. That's not my obligation. Faith is obedience. I'm not blind obedience. We'll talk about that in a moment. But faith is obedience. Even though the world sits there and says, that doesn't make any sense. Even though the world says, there's no way that could be true. Even though the world says, there's no way that God's going to do anything about this. God's, you know, you're putting your faith in pie in the sky. Faith is doing what God says simply because he said it. And I will let God figure out how he's going to finish the story, that if I'm writing the story, there is no way I fix this. But God is the author who can do, as Paul put it in the book of Ephesians, abundantly beyond all that you can ask or think. In other words, we serve a God, ladies and gentlemen, if we actually understand, and I think Abraham has gotten to the point where he's understanding this and the story is demonstrating this, that God simply isn't limited even by the boundaries of human imagination. Your God can do things that you can't even imagine in your wildest dreams. You can't even make it up. That's how outside of us God is. And so sometimes when I'm reading my Bible and this is what God asks of me, and it's going to have consequences or it doesn't seem how it's going to be possible. My job is just to do what God says and let God figure out how to connect the dots, draw the lines, and work out the ending. Now, one of the other things about this section before we press on, one of the other things about this story that's often noticed is how it seems to echo what God does with his own son. You ever heard that interpretation of this story before? It seems to echo what God's going to do with his own son. Because what's really fascinating is, and I think many of you have seen some of this pointed out before, well, it's not explicitly said to be the same land. That land of Moriah, in Chronicles is linked with the Temple Mount. That land of Moriah. There's no way, place names are often reused in the Bible, so there's no guarantee it's the exact same place. Genesis is not specific enough about which direction Abraham went. But there's certainly at least a reasonable speculation that this is the same place, at least the same vicinity as the temple will come to be built. And of course, Jesus was not crucified on the Temple Mount, but Jesus was crucified very close to the Temple Mount, you know, just a little ways away. God's own son, the 3 days, you hear the echoes of the 3 days in the tomb, and God's only son whom he loves, offered for the sin of the human race. That's an interesting line to think about. I'm not going to belabor that this morning. I want to get to some other things. But nonetheless, the way I like to put it sometimes, regardless if that's exactly the right way to connect Abram's story to the New Testament, this story to the New Testament, I will say this, and this is what I've often told people in hard times. I do not always know why God does what he does or asks what he asks or allows us to suffer what we suffer. But I can trust a God who will suffer with me in it, who does not hold himself exempt from what happens. And so there's a sense in which God will, in one sense, whether this is exactly a direct connection or not, God will, in one sense, do exactly with his own son what he asked Abram to do. Because that's the kind of God we serve. All right.
So Abram took the wood of the burnt offering, laid it on Isaac his son. He took in his hand the fire and the knife. The two of them walked on together. Isaac spoke to Abraham his father and said, "My father." And he said, "Here am I, my son." And he said to me, "Behold the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" That's got to, as a parent, I don't know how you take that. Or what you say there. Abram said, "God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son." I don't know, honestly, what Abram was thinking. I mean, he hasn't seen the ram in the bush yet. Does he really think that God's going to bear him out? Hebrew writers point, is he just going to raise him from the dead? He's actually going to go through with it, and God's just going to raise him from the dead. The real point is not that there's going to be a lamb as such. The real point is that God's going to provide. That however this works out, God's going to handle it, son. And that's the real issue. The issue is not the object. The issue is the subject in that sentence. God will provide, son. However this story plays out. And so the two of them walked on together. They came to the place which God had told them. And again, the language just piles on step by step. Abraham's determined obedience. And so he built the altar there. He arranged the wood. He bound his son Isaac. He laid him on the altar, on top of the wood. Again, gratuitous details meant to just heighten step by step Abraham, his heart surely breaking doing this. And then Abraham stretched out his hand. He took the knife to slay his son. And it's at that moment, God's just-in-time delivery system. It's in that moment that the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven, "Abraham, Abraham." And he said, "Here am I." And he said, "Do not stretch out your hand against the lad and do nothing to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." And so Abraham raised his eyes and looked. And behold, behind him a ram caught in the thicket by his horns. Again, the language I find intriguing. Abraham raised his eyes and looked. Was the ram there the whole time and Abraham just hadn't noticed it? Did it miraculously pop in there at the last moment and now he sees it? Was he just oblivious or was it was always there? I don't know that it really matters how the ram got there, whether it was there the whole time or not. The point is that there is a certain kind of vision. There's a certain way of seeing life that comes from obedience to God. You see the world differently. You see your things differently. You see your point and purpose in life differently. You see God differently. There's a vision that comes. You stop and think about how much even in the Bible vision matters. You think about in the Bible, Jesus gives sight to the blind miraculously, but he also talks about woe to those who have eyes but don't see and ears but don't hear. In a sense, his healings of blind people are meant to illustrate a spiritual truth, which is that it's only when you basically come to God on God's terms and accept him as he reveals himself and calls us to obey him, it's only then that you really begin to see. It's only then that you really begin to know this. And so it's at this point, that when God says to him, "Now I know you fear God," that Abraham sees a ram. It's only when we honestly give our lives and everything in them to God, no matter how contradictory, hard, how much suffering it may bring, whatever, that we really begin to see the world as God intends it to be. And now Abram can see God's provision because he didn't see it before. That wouldn't have been much for faith. He only sees it after he is truly let go. And God can say, "You fear me. I see that. No doubt about that now. Hand, knife, everything missing, everything there but the downstroke. Now I know." And Abraham sees. And he names the name of that place, "The Lord will provide," which is an interesting translation because in Hebrew, the verb that is actually used, there's the same verb for seeing that's kind of been running through this story, actually. That basically, it's the place where the Lord will see. Providing is a way of seeing, by the way, just to connect the dots here real quick. Provide is kind of Latin-based, but when you stop and think about it, pro, to plan before, pro is before, vide, video, Latin, the root for seeing is vid. To provide is to see before, to anticipate, and to therefore set aside what you're going to need for your trip or whatever. You see before something. In Hebrew, it's actually just basically the Lord sees, interpreted by our translations as "the Lord will provide." The Lord sees. The Lord knows. The Lord always knows what's going on. The question is, do you see what God sees, the way God sees? And Abraham only sees in this story when he's basically let go of everything that mattered to him in life. Maybe a little bit of an overstatement, but I think you get the point. He has spent decades of his life wandering the wilderness in a tent, waiting for this God to deliver. And then this God asks for him to give it back. And with that child, giving that child back, giving back everything that God had said would come through that child. And so it is a powerful story, and it powerfully, I think, speaks to the issue of faith for us. And so the angel called Abraham, just to finish this chapter a little bit, and then we'll make some observations, and our time will be gone. The angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, "By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son." Notice how the language always piles it up. The nature of this test, it's always your son, your only son, whom you love. It's always elaborated. "Indeed, I will greatly bless you, and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens, as the sand which is on the seashore, and your seed shall possess the gate of their enemies. In your seed all the nations shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice." You've established, Abram, that you are the father of the kind of family I want. A family that is truly based upon faith. Yeah, there's a biological son involved here, but really it's about that deeper spiritual reality. And so Abraham returned to his young men. They arose, they went back together to Beersheba. And Abraham lived there at Beersheba. And so let's talk about making sense of the story here a little bit in the few minutes that we have left together this morning. Let's talk a little bit about how we make sense of this story. And a lot of ways, actually, some of this we've already done. We've already talked our way through. The amount of time that Abraham has to wait, that intense desire for a son that runs through all these chapters, it really is the driving force of Abraham's relationship with God. God, what Abraham is really looking to God for is that son. Yes, we always divide it up into those three other promises, but in Abraham's own words, it's about that boy. It's about that son. There's an excruciating story there that brings Abraham's life to a climax when he's asked to give that son back. But what we haven't talked about as much yet is that fourth point there. This story is both a test of Abraham, but also as a type. As a type. That's the Hebrew's word. In Hebrews chapter 11, when the Hebrew does add his inspired commentary on this story, in Hebrews chapter 11, it's important the way the Hebrew writer puts it in Hebrews chapter 11. By faith, verse 17 is where I'm at. "By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac." And again, you've, I think, heard this, you know, pointed out before. That the whole point is, in God's eyes, Abraham had done it. Even though he did not literally kill Isaac, Abraham's heart, mind, will, through that story, demonstrated that Abraham, if God had not called, Abraham would have finished that last step. The knife would have come down. Abram offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was offering up his only begotten son. See, the Hebrew writer gets the dynamic. Abram received these promises, and he was offering up the only son through whom these promises can come. "The one whom it was said, 'In Isaac shall your descendants be called.'" The Hebrew writer gets this dynamic, that this is what's really driving it. It doesn't matter if God miraculously gives Sarah another boy. God has already said, not just any son of Sarah, this son of Sarah. And now God says to Abram, "Give me back that son." "And he considered that God was able to raise people even from the dead, from which he also received him back as a type." Now, that word "type" in the Bible, we often kind of fly over that too much, move too quickly. What does that mean that he calls it a type? It's an example. But the difference between a type and a sign or example, and this is what I want you to understand, is that it participates in the thing itself. Types actually participate. They're not just kind of an example of this. The type participates in it. It is a shadow of the thing. It is part of the thing itself. Isaac's return from the dead is a type of the resurrection that all of God's people are looking for and longing for in faith. Because at the end of the day, Abraham's life and Isaac's life, the beginning of Israel, we are now the Israel of God. Israel comes out of this exact dynamic. This is where Isaac really comes from. This is the nature of Isaac's life. And again, when you look at what the Hebrew is saying, Isaac died and was raised from the dead, as far as the dynamics of the story. He died and he was raised from the dead. That's how you and I are called to live life, ladies and gentlemen. How do you know you're going to be raised from the dead in the last day, really? Faith. But the real test really comes out in our daily lives. Do we actually live lives that show, "I'm really convinced there's going to be something better after this"? Do I really do that at work when my boss wants me to cook the books or else? Let go of your job, God would say.
there's something else out there. Let me connect the dots and finish the story, and your life will be fine. You're living for not this type. You're living for the antitype. You're living for the real deal. Jesus, the down payment, and yours in the end. Can you live a life where you die and you rise, as often as needed, metaphorically speaking? It's a type. We are called to participate in this. Ourselves, Abraham participated in it, and this is the walk that we are called as well to do. And so it's really, at the end of the day, it's about faith. Let's really deepen what faith is. Often what happens when we talk about faith, we only talk about it in one of two senses. Number one, we talk about faith as the intellectual acceptance of certain facts as true. And so Jesus is the Son of God. You accept that by faith. I have faith. Jesus is the Son of God. I intellectually assent to facts as so. That is part of faith. The second type of faith, though, and this is the one we typically emphasize more, is believing in what God has said enough to obey it. That's James's faith, right? You know, a saving faith that believes enough to obey. Don't say you believe in God if you don't do what he says. And that's true, too. But can you obey God grudgingly? Can you do what he says? You have enough faith that you do it because you have to? Well, sure. There's a third aspect of faith that God is looking for, and this is what we often forget. Because you can give God letter of the law, grudging obedience, because, well, you just don't want to go to hell when you die. That's still, that is, in a sense, a faith. You have a faith that God can send you to hell. And so you're going to do what you do because you have to. As one of my preacher friends used to put it, you just want eternal fire insurance. That's what you're really in it for. But there's a third aspect of faith that really rounds out what God is looking for. And this is what you find in Abraham, and this is what we are called to. And it's the faith of allegiance and loyalty. I don't just do it because I have to. I am convinced that God is real. I'm convinced he has power. I'm convinced heaven and hell. And so I'm going to do what he says because I have to, not because I want to. And this is where Abraham is, in a sense, perfected by faith. James appeals to this story. Abraham perfected in faith. Because this is what demonstrates that God has Abraham's absolute allegiance. When Abram will even let go of the reward itself to simply do what God says because he's God. Let me ask you something this morning, a hard question. Would you do what's right even if there wasn't a heaven just because God asked you to? Would you do what's right simply because God asked you to even if there was no heaven, there was no reward? That probes the heart a little bit, doesn't it? Doing things just because it's right. Because in a sense, what God's asking him to do is give me back the promise. Give me back the reward. I want to see if you're in it for me or if you're just in it for the money. And that's an old human dilemma. That's what drives the book of Job, remember? That's an old human. What does Satan say about Job to God? Does Job fear God for nothing? You've made him rich. Lots of kids. A wife. Well, no, let's not go there with the wife, apparently. But you read the story. You know, that's Satan's whole point to God. The only reason, God, why Job fears you and obeys you is because you paid him off. To which God says, I accept that challenge. Take away everything but his life and see what he does. And so Job loses everything, even down to his health. Probably wishing he was dead. He makes that explicit. Wishing that Satan, you know, he doesn't know it's Satan, but wishing that it would just finish it off. And at the end of the day, Job will not sin with his lips. He will not give Satan the satisfaction of being right before God. He will not deny God for the sake of getting his stuff back. He doesn't know why God's doing it. He wishes God would answer him. He'll cry out, God, come down and answer me. Let the Almighty answer me. Shouldn't have said that. You don't tell God what he has to do and when he has to do it. But he will not basically give up his relationship with God. He serves God because he is God. And so Satan has to leave metaphorical tail between the legs. Because Job has proved himself to be trustworthy of God's great praise. He does it simply because it's right. Not because of the stuff. Those are the kind of people, ladies and gentlemen, that God is looking for. The kind of people who will do what God asks and what God says simply because it's right. Because he's called us to it. And so at the end of the day, it's all about that third aspect of faith that we often forget, that allegiance. To give God what he wants, to trust him enough to obey him no matter what he says and how confusing or contradictory it seems. But we do it because we believe he's God and we love him. Of course, what God does, well, he doesn't want just mental acceptance. He doesn't want you just acknowledge him as God because you have no alternative or because you have to.
He doesn't want just happy thoughts. He doesn't want us to kind of talk our way out of it. You know, there's no denying that there's suffering. There's no denying that sometimes there is inexplicable suffering. He doesn't want us to just sit there and say happy thoughts. Worst thing you can say to a suffering person is have faith, in a sense. That's happy talk. No, this pain is real. This suffering is real. It may well be unjust, and there is no explanation for it. And he doesn't want us taking risks for their own sake. You know, he doesn't want us putting God to the test as though somehow that were virtuous. You know, that's what Satan was asking Jesus to do in the temptation, right? Throw yourself off the temple and see if God will catch you. But God, no, you don't put God to the test. But you do sit there and you say, what is it in my life that I'm holding on to? This was the issue with the rich young ruler's dynamic, right? Good moral kid. Nice boy. Well raised, we'd say. What must I do to inherit eternal life? He asked Jesus. And you remember the story. Jesus reminds him of some of the Ten Commandments, you know, mostly the negative ones. No adultery, none of that kind of stuff. From my youth up, I've done that, he says. And you remember how the story ends. Jesus says, well, then go sell all that you have, give to the poor, and follow me. Have treasure in heaven. And he went away sorrowful because Jesus had found the sweet spot. Jesus had found the sweet spot. I have no problem being moral. I have a problem not worshiping money, right? I mean, let's be honest with ourselves. Cheating on my wife is really not a temptation for me. But not being materialistic sometimes, that's a little different. No other gods before me, God said. No other gods before me. Jesus sometimes says, sell all that you possess. Not because it's wrong to have stuff. But sometimes we need to intentionally let go of things just to remind ourselves that we live not by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. I'll tell you, we are rightly afraid of the misuse of religious rituals like fasting or something like that. But you know, Jesus did in Matthew chapter 6 talk about when you fast, as though it's just assumed that we would, not as a church activity, but individually sometimes. You know what the value of doing something like that is? Learning to say no to even legitimate desires to remind ourselves to stay focused on that which lasts forever. In a country of such abundance and such distraction, would we not all be spiritually improved from time to time, taking periods in our life to say no to even legitimate things? Not because they're wrong, not because we're going to be ritualistic or pharisaical about it, but simply because there is good spiritual discipline and learning to let go. What about this? If you love your family more than me, you're not worthy. I'll tell you, when the border of the kingdom of God runs through families, that's hard. But it happens. It happens in my family. It probably happens in some of your families as well. It's certainly a case in my family. And that leads to some hard decisions sometimes, especially when you think about children, influence. You know, grandparents don't understand. Grandparents get upset. Why we can't come. Why we have to go to church every Sunday. Whatever it is. Why we don't want them giving them that gift or watching that movie. Well, you know, all sorts of ways. Get ourselves in the hot spots. If you love your family more than me, you're not worthy, Jesus says. And then Jesus says, even really it comes down to life itself. It comes down to life itself. The one who loves his life will lose it. And the one who loses his life for my sake will find it. Can you give back to God that which is nearest and dearest to you? This is the essence of Israel. This is literally the beginning of Israel. This is Isaac. So when you stop and think about it, the rest of Genesis, Isaac doesn't do much in the story. Isaac does not do much in the story, does he? I mean, there's there, Rebekah, he's comforted afterwards. In some ways, the story focuses much about Rebekah and those two kids struggling in her womb. Oh, man, that's going to be fun when those boys come out. Two nations in your womb, they're already fighting now. Wait till you see what they do to each other when they're actually walking around. It's going to get a lot worse before it gets any better. Isaac really doesn't appear much in the story. The story of Isaac is Genesis 22. The story of the nature of his existence. The story of the nature of what he serves before God with Abraham. The actual beginning of the family of faith. And this is our story. This is, again, who and what we become. This is what God calls us to do. This is how God calls us to live. And so may God help us to realize sometimes it's not just about finding those lists of commands. It's not just about finding the kind of that checklist of the entry steps to heaven like you do when you go out of the country, get your visa, you know, do this with the embassy, mail in here, get stamped here, that. God shows us in stories what this life looks like. And it is on one hand terrifying, but that's why it's called faith, because ultimately I trust in him. even Job in that great moment in the book, though he slay me, yet I will trust him. God help us to learn to live the life of Abraham, the life of Isaac, who submitted to all this, but really to recognize what Isaac really represents, which is a life that lets go of everything to God to receive his blessing on his time, his way. All right. Well, you have let me ramble on. Well, I appreciate that. Got a couple minutes left. I'll just say any comments, questions, objections, refutations, disavowals.
I'm sorry. I forgot to tell y'all that he talks real.
Yeah. I'm actually calm this morning. I didn't have any coffee. My defense, by the way, is my parents were Northerners. They were Yankees. My mom was from Philly. My dad was from upstate New York. So I can't help it. I was born that way. But I got to Texas as fast as I could. So I know, excuses. Yeah, we've been there, done that. Anything? I'm sorry? That's right. That's right.
Remember the comment God made, Genesis 18, verse 19, I have chosen him, I've chosen Abraham, that he may command his children and his household. You want to comment on that?
Yeah, again, I think that goes back to a great illustration of what the family of Abraham really is. And it's not DNA, it's a spiritual kinship. That his family in the flesh obviously will fail pretty catastrophically to keep on. But that's the point of being chosen by God, is to become God's kindred, to know him and to serve him and to walk in his ways. And even that language is really great. It's really not about specific commands. It's a lifestyle. The commands just kind of give us the guardrails of that lifestyle, but we need not to think of this as a rule-based as such, kind of legal thing. It's a relationship, and the rules, the commandments are really kind of the guide rails to have this, make this relationship with God possible. It is a relationship we're called to have. We are family of God, children of Abraham.
So it wasn't an accident that Abraham
No. In fact, and what's interesting about that as well is, and I thought about actually trying to work this in this morning, but I was afraid it was all going to take up too much time. Romans chapter 9, Paul's commentary on this story is really, really interesting. In fact, even as the bell catches us, look at Romans 9 real quick. This is kind of interesting because Paul's actually going to explicitly cite a couple of lines from the text that we have been in this morning. Now, we don't usually read Romans 9 through 11. We're kind of scared of that. We're afraid it's going to turn us into Calvinists or something. All that election talk and stuff. So we honestly stay out of here, I think, for the most part. And that's unfortunate because there's really, and in some ways, Romans 9 through 11 is actually the crux of Paul's actual overarching argument in Romans. And so a lot of times we stop in chapter 8 and think we've hit the climax. But theologically, what Paul's actually writing, the climax is 9 through 11. Chapter 9. Part of what God, or just a quick jump in the middle of it here. Romans 9 is where Paul is now beginning this section to explain how God is righteous. You know, why should I become a Christian if I can kind of play devil's advocate here? Why should I become a Christian if it doesn't look like God kept his promises? And the reason it looks like God kept his promises is if he made these promises to Abraham and yet so many Jews aren't being saved by the gospel, what's happening to God's people? Or have the promises of God failed? And so Paul's got to basically go back and say, no, we need to go back and we need to reread these stories again, is what he's actually doing. He'll only pull a couple lines of quotes here and there, but conceptually what he's basically saying is, no, you need to go back and you need to reread Genesis again because of texts like the one Mark alluded to a second ago or the ones that Paul picks up on here. And so if you pick up, let's start chapter 9, verse 6. But it is not as though the word of God has failed. For not all who are descended from Israel belong to Israel. That's a great line. Now, all who have descended from Israel are actually Israel. And watch how he illustrates that. Just like, verse 7, not all are children of Abraham because they are his offspring, but, and now he quotes from Genesis, through Isaac shall your offspring be named. In other words, just because you are literally seed of Abraham does not mean even the Genesis that you are actually one of God's children of promise, right? Because Ishmael was actually a child of Abraham, right? And Ishmael is not a son of Abraham, theologically speaking. There was something more than, in other words, what Paul's saying is there was always something more than the flesh, DNA, involved in what God is doing. It's about God's choice. And so the real question becomes, not so much why does God judge, because we're out of time. The real question what Paul's going to say is not why does he basically judge or find fault. The real question is why does he show mercy at all? That's the real question. Why does God choose to show mercy in the first place? That's where you learn who God really is, not in his judgment. But we're out of time, and that's it.